Cooper with the Hour of the Time right here on WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, in the United States of America.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening once again to the Hour of the Time, and I'm your host today, Michelle. We will be continuing with our review and search through the Basic Training Handbook of the American Underground tonight, part 3 in the series. So without further ado, get pencil and paper by your side, and we will continue after this short pause. Today, clothed in Patriot garb, who would have you believe that there is nothing that you can do, that our struggle is a hopeless one, said, it's already over. They are lying to you. It is not over. It is not hopeless. We must have the passionate courage of our convictions and beliefs to stand to the very last, no matter what that last may be. People without hope are people without a plan. If you have a plan, if you have training, if you have options before you, then you can continue to stand and to move and to achieve in this struggle that we are engaged in. And this is why we are taking the time to review this basic training handbook of the American Underground. We left off in our last episode discussing personal security, and we are at this moment in phase 3 of the Underground training program. I will continue. We could discuss the techniques of shadowing, wiretapping, and photographic surveillance, etc., but all this will be taken up later as part of the technical tools of espionage and counter-espionage. Good personal security is not so much a matter of technical skill as it is a certain frame of mind, a proper mental attitude. Here are some general guidelines. 1. The successful espionage agent will develop the habit of stopping to think about what he is to say before he actually says it. A slip of the tongue may mean his life. He avoids idle chatter and casual conversations because experience has proven that it is during such times as these, when his guard is down, that the individual agent is most apt to give himself away. There is another good reason why every member of an anti-communist organization should avoid loose talk. Each of us must strive to develop the qualities of leadership that will be required of us in the fight that is ahead. One requirement of leadership is to hold the respect of your associates. It is truly said that familiarity breeds contempt. It might be added that nothing breeds familiarity quite as fast as a long, rambling, useless conversation. The federal government can and does tap telephones without a court order. Right now, there are 11 different agencies of the United States government that routinely use telephone monitoring in their contact with ordinary citizens. And I might remind the listeners that the material I am reading to you is approximately 35 years old. There are many more agencies at this time that routinely monitor the telephone calls with their contacts with citizens. And there has been legislation passed allowing the FBI to do phone taps without a court order. I continue. He must be cautious in his use of the mail. For nearly two centuries, the mail of American citizens has been considered to be their own personal business. The contents of first-class letters mailed in one part of the United States for delivery in another part was strictly confidential. Several years ago, the Postal Department began a practice known as a mail cover. A mail cover for any individual or company may be requested by the Justice Department, Selective Service, Internal Revenue, or many other government agencies. This simply means that the post office keeps a record of all persons to whom you send mail or from whom you receive mail. Still, this was done entirely from the address or return address on the outside of the envelope. During the past year, the government has adopted a new attitude towards first-class mail. They now contend that our mail, while in the possession of the Postal Service, becomes the property of the Postmaster General to open, read, or reroute as he or his agent needs to fit. The principles of newness and personal security. Security is often thought of as secrecy, but this doesn't tell the whole story. Many things have been shrouded in secrecy and at the same time lack real security. The best example of this is the Manhattan Project during World War II. It was so secret that most of the people who worked there didn't know what the project was about or what they were trying to do as a whole. But on the face of this great shroud of secrecy, Russian intelligence agents cracked the security of the Manhattan Project and thus secrets of an atomic bomb. Number one, the principle of deception. Quote, complete deception is indispensable to the success of these covert operations. End quote. That is from Colonel Virgil Ray, writing in Notes on Guerrilla War, published by Command Publications in Washington, 1961, page 18. Quote, in the first condition of being a resistance member and maintaining normal and usual attitudes and characteristics, the basic requirement is to be a good actor or pretender. In addition to some histrionic skill, this condition calls for quick wit, ready answers, and often high nobility. End quote. That was by Ernie O'Leary, quoted in Army Without Banners, Adventures of an Irish Volunteer, published in Boston by the Houghton Mifflin Company in 1937, pages 148 and 149. 2. The principles of classifying all information. Information means all communications that are spoken or written. It is anything about the personnel, movement, aims, objectives, and means employed that would aid the enemy. All information should be classified into one of the following five groups. In most art cases, these five groups would serve the needs of the underground organization. Class 1, top secret. This security classification is reserved for the most important records and communications. Records carrying this classification are available only with consent in writing, signed by at least two different members of the security division of the underground unit. Communications of this classification are to be read only by the person or persons they are specifically addressed to, and then destroyed. This classification should be reserved to only the most important information, where its interception might result in the death of some member, or where vital plans, programs, or data would be compromised. Care should be exercised that this classification is not used immediately, otherwise it will lose its value. Class 2, secret. This classification is used for records, communications, and information relating to current organization activities, plans, or personnel. Secret communications are to be in code, given over the telephone or by mail, unless it is certain that both the sending and receiving addresses are secure. Otherwise, they must be delivered in person or by courier. Class 3, restricted. This is the normal classification for advanced training materials and routine organizational correspondence. Class 4, classified. This is used for preliminary training material, correspondence to provisional members, and literature not meant for public distribution. And class 5, security literature and similar public information, non-classified. Number 3, the principle of obedience. All members must abide by the rules that are adopted by the underground organization concerning security. And this also includes the classification that any information is assigned on the national level. Before any band makes a public statement, writes a letter to the editor, or any other public manifestation, it should be cleared through a chain of security officers. This could be county security, district security, state security, regional security, and national security officers. To keep the red tape to a minimum, the national and regional security officers could furnish the state security officer with guidelines and allow them to make some of the decisions on the local level. In all cases, the lower levels of command must abide by the decisions made in higher headquarters. If anyone disobeys, they jeopardize all involved. 4. The principle of continued inspection. Why continually inspect? Because people change. The biggest thieves are usually trusted with very large responsibilities. The trustworthy person of today may be dishonest tomorrow. Proof of the above is seen in every embezzlement case. Not only do people change, but places, things, and measures change in their security value. Give any halfway intelligent espionage network enough time, and they will crack the security of any organization that does not continually instruct its people, places, things, measures, and systems. Eternal vigilance is the price of absolute security. These principles are true for both sides. 5. The principle of avoiding attention. One way for an individual, band, or movement to die a quick and sure death is to attract undue attention to itself prematurely. The most effective underground movers are unknown to the enemy until they have enough strength and support to inflict damage to the enemy and to sustain their continuance. Quote, premature commitment is the finest help the resistance can give the enemy in his effort to liquidate those who would fight. Regardless of the temptation to rush into combat with all that is available in weapons and manpower, this desire must be resisted. End quote. That's from Travis Ingham, quoted in Rendezvous by Submarine, published in the work of Webber Gray, Durant and Company, 1945, page 61. Quote, in other words, the ability to keep out of the clutches of the enemy's secret police or agents is the first primary mission of the resistor, insofar as basic personal security is concerned. That's also by Colonel Virgil Ney, Notes on Guerrilla Warfare, published by Command Publications in Washington, 1961, page 154. Number 6. Principle of fluid change. This is best seen in often changes in the locations of meeting places, weapons caches, and so forth. This same principle can be applied to an organization. Think of a local organization as a cell with different members. The enemy intelligence finds out that the cell in question exists, but before they can penetrate the security of the cell, it becomes non-existent by using the principle of change. This is done by using a shotgun type of scatter technique, or splitting the cell to form other cells with the same and additional functions. It is not necessary for all members to change locations. You see this principle in operation every time a covey of quail scatters. The idea is to scatter, reorganize in different groups, and reach functionality one step ahead of the enemy intelligence. This principle is necessary because if given enough time, proper intelligence can crack the security of any organization. It means to remain fluid, so old security measures must be constantly replaced with additional new security measures that are just as effective and better than the old ones. Number 7, the principle of time. Unless these conditions are adopted early in the life of the movement and continued, the chance of the resistance survival is nil. Conclusion. There are three words that describe the elements of a sound security program. System, supervision, action. System. A security program is on the right track if procedures are outlined and made clear to all personnel. Each member must be trained to work the system involved. Above all, their enthusiasm must be kept at a high peak. Supervision. Nothing runs by itself except that which is going downhill. And even that must be supervised or else it winds up in the ditch. The best system in the world is no better than the attending supervision. Action. All personnel must be alert to the problem. All must know what to do and what not to do in regard to unit and personal security. The program cannot be made up to the leaders of the underground or to the bands involved. The whole membership of the underground organization must be enlisted to action. Sometimes this action must be directed against offenders. Firm enforcement puts teeth into a security program. The conflict will not be won on the security front by observing one or more of these principles. All must be followed diligently. And even when all of this is done, we still must remain alert 24 hours a day. Remember, it is he who lets his guard down first and most that loses the game. We have remarked above on the efforts being made to determine the identity of our members by use of moral covers and similar actions. How can we counteract this interference with our right to openly and safely use the United States mail? Certainly not by appealing to the postal inspectors. We've tried that. Certainly not by the protection of our federal postal laws. Our only effective means of protecting our right of privacy is to rely on the 7 principles of security that we learned in our basic training program. To review, the principle of deception, the use of fictitious names, of letter drops, the use of innocent appearing letters, of postcards that carry our messages in hidden codes of ciphers. 2, the principle of classification, use of the most secure methods of communication for the most important information. Use less secure methods for less important messages, rather than flood your secure lines of communication with unimportant material. 3, the principle of obedience. Do not risk the loss of a secure means of communication by careless or lazy action. 4, the principle of continuous inspection. Continuously recheck on the security of your communications. Do not continue to use a means of communication after it may have been compromised by lack of proper inspection. 5, the principle of avoiding attention. Do nothing that makes the outside of your envelope look conspicuous. If you use tape or wax to help seal your letters, these should be on an inside envelope where they will not attract attention. Patriotic slogans or stickers should never be used on letters containing confidential information. 6, the principle of fluid change. Do not continue to use the same fictitious name, address, or other deceptive means so long that it becomes stale. 7, the principle of time. Prepare secure addresses, secret letter drops, and lines of communication well ahead of time, so they will be ready when needed. Practical security measures. 1, use deceptive measures. Subscribe to one or more left-wing periodicals or get on the mailing list of some peace movement. This will keep the postal inspectors guessing as to which side you are really on. While doing this, underground members can be of great assistance in searching this left-wing literature for names and addresses of fellow travelers for intelligence files. People are desperately needed to assist in this activity. If you are interested in this field, please inquire for further information. 2, always use 2 envelopes in sending mail to any patriotic organization or to any other member of our underground organization. Do not put a return address on the outer envelope. Put your return address on the inside envelope with the words Return Postage Guaranteed. 3, place some opaque material, such as tinfoil, carbon paper, or some similar substance between the inner and outer envelopes to prevent your mail from being read by infrared cameras. 4, send all letters from corner mailboxes or from post offices where you are not known. 5, be careful in the use of the telephone. Avoid telephone calls to a headquarters or to known members of the organization as much as possible. 6, prepare telephone codes ahead of time for future protection. 7, in recruiting new members, always learn as much as you can about the prospective recruit and make sure he is not an infiltrator before you identify yourself as a member of the organization. 8, Members of the underground organization in each area should be divided into four groups. Those who have been identified publicly or by law enforcement agencies as members of the underground. B. Those persons not known as members of the underground, but who are generally known as bad patriots. C. Those persons who have kept their political beliefs hidden. And D. Members who profess to be liberal for the purpose of infiltrating enemy organizations. All members should be very careful in making contact with persons in a different category than themselves. For example, people in Class D should be very secret in their contact with persons in Class A or B. Each member must respect the security of every other member. Do not, under any circumstances, identify one of the organization, even to other members, without his express permission on each and every occasion. 9. Avoid loose talk. Do not discuss organizational plans in public places where you could be overheard. Do not even hint at such a discussion in the presence of non-members. 10. Do not write patriotic letters to newspapers or magazines under your own name. To do so achieves very little except to identify you to the enemy. 11. If you are already known as a patriot or as a member of the underground, you may find it advisable to spread the rumor that you have become disillusioned with the right wing or for you to pretend a gradual loss of interest. 12. Classify your various members' addresses, your communications, and your other activities as top secret, secret, or confidential. Use your most secret lines of communications only for the most important messages rather than flooding them with unimportant material. 13. Demand obedience to all security measures from all members. Persistent disregard for security measures should be cause for disciplinary action. 14. Check your lines of communications from time to time by sending phony messages to make certain they are not intercepted. 15. Change mail drops, meeting places, etc. frequently. 16. Prepare secret rendezvous points, mail drops, etc. now. May be used in time of some future emergency. 17. Each band should assign some member the rank of security officer and should set up a system of fines or other penalties for failure to comply with security precautions. 18. Observe the need-to-know rule. Each member should be given only that information which is needed by him in the performance of his duties or which he will need in cooperating with other members of the band. No member should feel left out because he is denied such information. Instead, every member should willingly avoid information that he doesn't know. 19. Be careful that you are not followed in going to and from meeting places or in making contact with other members of the organization. And 20. Keep all records and correspondence carefully hidden and in a manner that they can be easily destroyed. Records should be kept in code whenever possible. And we will return to the training program in just a moment.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading, specialists in precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, in bullion, numismatic coins, junk silver, in just about every configuration imaginable, and in every configuration that might be right for you and your personal budget. If you haven't made that call to Swiss America to see what you can do to protect your assets against the coming economic collapse, Virginite, make that call today. They can help you. You will need precious metals in the coming conflict, and you will need precious metals to survive the economic collapse that is sure to come. Swiss America Trading has sponsored the Hour of the Time for many, many years, in spite of the heat that they have taken because of the controversial nature of this program. The Hour of the Time has brought to you documented and sourced very controversial material for many years, and Swiss America has stood by the program as thick and thin. Their courage and determination should be recognized and rewarded. When you call Swiss America, thank them for sponsoring the Hour of the Time, and ask them how they can help you protect your assets and prepare for the future by the acquisition of precious metals. Call Swiss America. Don't put it off any longer. The number is 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Swiss America Trading. Ready to enter phase 4 of the underground training program. This is the final phase, and it is lengthy. I will not finish it today. We will continue it in the next episode. Phase 4 deals wholly and specifically with propaganda. any action on the part of one group which is calculated to affect the thinking of another group may be considered as propaganda. The Germans used the term intellectual warfare. In the United States, the traditional term is psychological warfare. The British used the term political warfare. In the USSR, our warfare is considered political, and the communists brought popularity to the word propaganda in referring to the German efforts in this field during World War I and to an even greater extent during World War II. Only the enemy is presumed to use propaganda, and thus the word has developed the idea of falseness, while our own psychological warfare was always assumed to be the truth. For briefness, we will use the familiar term propaganda in most cases. The best propaganda always has some grain of truth in it, something which the audience will readily believe and from which their mental processes can be guided in the desired direction. Propaganda may, of course, be entirely true, but maximum advantage is gained for its originator by proper timing or by accenting certain facts and neglecting others. The term propaganda comes from the word propagate, which in this regard means to travel along chiefly under its own power. A newspaper cannot travel by itself. For the contents of a newspaper, or even a radio broadcast, to reach maximum distribution, it must be passed on by word of mouth from one person to another. Thus, propaganda becomes fully effective only when its message reaches the level of a rumor. In this manner, its continued propagation is assured, and it will ultimately reach a far greater number of people than those who saw or heard the original message. The use of propaganda is a science, and to use it most effectively, several things must be considered. 1. The purpose of the propaganda. 2. The audience to whom it is directed. 3. The means by which it is to be delivered. 4. The motives to which it appeals. 5. The purported source of the propaganda. 6. Propaganda intelligence. 7. Propaganda security. And 8. Production. The propaganda purpose. There are many different possible objectives of propaganda. To improve the morale of one's own troops, to spur friendly civilians to greater productive efforts, to help make the people willingly accept the hardships of war, to convince our people of the justice of our own cause, to build confidence in our own organization, to sustain belief in our political system, to develop contempt for the enemy, to convince non-committed neutrals that we are right and our enemies are wrong, to convince neutral troops that our side will win and that they should join on the winning side, to demoralize the enemy, to destroy the enemy's confidence in their leaders, to convince the enemy that their ultimate defeat is inevitable. These are but a few. Most important is to decide in advance exactly what effect is desired from each particular propaganda message and arrange all other factors toward the achievement of that end. The purpose should be kept simple and realistic. The audience. Careful consideration must be given to both the desired audience and the actual audience which will be reached by a given propaganda message. There is obviously little to be gained by urging the citizens of Brazil to vote Democratic and urging the citizens of Japan to vote the straight Republican ticket. The audience selected must be able to react in the desired way so as to achieve the propaganda purpose. The message must be designed to achieve the desired effect in those people that it actually reaches. If a propaganda message is to be most effective, it must be directed to a specific audience. 1. At the enemy, to convert, to confuse, to destroy morale, to misdirect. 2. At neutral, an attack, to gain support, to prevent them from helping the enemy. 3, at our own people, to boost morale, to build courage, to develop a fighting spirit with confidence in victory. Means of delivery. Some of the various media which can be used to carry the propaganda message are as follows. Television, radio, newspaper, magazine, books, pamphlets, leaflets, handbills, gummed stickers, posters, billboards, loudspeakers, novelties, air raffles, motion pictures, mail, public meetings, rumors, demonstrations, and telephone solicitations. Television. This is perhaps the most powerful media available for propaganda in the United States. Tests have shown that more people will believe a piece of news told them by a TV commentator than if they read it in the newspapers. The communist socialist conspiracy has infiltrated the television media deeply and is using it with great skill in promoting a subtle version of the communist line. The opportunity for American patriots to use television in giving our side of the story are very limited. The expense of even a few minutes of time on a major television network is prohibitively expensive for most patriotic organizations. Even if we could afford a reasonable amount of television time, the effect would be small compared to the considerable periods of time which the other side receives free or sponsored by liberal-leaning advertising. The money could certainly be spent better in other ways. Occasional guest programs offer some opportunity for patriots to get free television time. Past experience has proven this to be a generally poor bargain. Spliced TV tape, improper lighting, biased moderators, and a host of other tricks can be, and generally are, used to make the patriot guest look absolutely ridiculous. Newspapers and magazines. These are the second and third most potent vehicles for propaganda within the United States. Like television, they are largely controlled by the communist-socialist conspiracy. Newspapers are somewhat more susceptible to local control, as they are more dependent on local advertisers for their income. Considerable tact is required to gain the cooperation of advertisers in this respect. If approached in the wrong way, most of them may spring to the defense of the offending publication. This does not mean that we should completely abandon all the most powerful media to our enemies. Patriots in each major city should either join or form a chapter of the Committee for Responsible Journalism. These committees monitor local TV stations and newspapers, making note of particularly bad propaganda programs. A list of all the advertisers of such media are compiled with their addresses and telephone numbers. Repeated telephone calls to the editor or program director, as well as the advertisers, should include firm but courteous requests for retractions of false statements or for equal time on controversial issues. Care should be taken not to alienate individual newspaper publishers, journalists, radio announcers, and so forth by rudely denouncing them. Most may be liberal, but few are actual communists. Many can be influenced by courteous and logical persuasion. Well-written news releases about local patriotic activities will frequently be carried in even the liberal papers if presented in person to the city editor. Radio. There has been a big change in commercial radio in the last few years. Less time is devoted to live programs, more to recorded music. With this change, radio has dropped in potency as a propaganda media within the United States. Many patriotic organizations and individuals are spending considerable sums of money on radio programs at the present time. Unfortunately, the actual value of such programs is frequently reduced by lack of proper research and through careless presentation. Some stations carry audience participation, open line programs, where listeners can phone in and air their views. If planned properly, a campaign to use these programs can be effective. Each call by a patriot should be thought out on theirs. To be most effective, all the aspects of presentation, motive, continuity, specific purpose, etc. must be considered. Care should be taken not to offend the radio announcer conducting such programs. To the contrary, effort should be made to gain his sympathy for the pro-American cause. Some members who are amateur radio operators have tried talking back and forth between each other in hopes of dispensing pro-American information to others that might be listening in. Experience has shown that the audience that can be obtained in this way is not worth the time and money involved. For our organization at this time, radio must be reserved as a means of communication. In case of future communist takeover, some of the more powerful communications transmitters might be converted to other frequencies for clandestine propaganda purposes. Motion pictures. The motion picture industry is also heavily infiltrated by communists, with many of the most famous writers, actors, and directors having known communist affiliations. There is little we can do in this regard except to boycott the shows that include the most brazen propaganda. Organized ticketing and the distribution of handbills in front of theaters showing such films might also be effective, but this must be done either by persons whose political beliefs are already known or in such a way that the identity of the core members is not compromised. Some private films, such as those produced at Harding College, are excellent for showing to small private groups and civic organizations. Printed material. Small printed items, such as leaflets and booklets, make up the biggest current media for patriotic propaganda. For this reason, they should be given special care, so far as printing, artwork, etc. is concerned. This will be discussed in detail under the heading of production. Mail. The U.S. Postal Service is currently the principal means of delivery for patriotic literature. Mail has certain advantages, such as flexibility, comparative certainty of delivery, speed, and so forth. Generally, it is more expensive per thousand members of the audience than magazines or newspapers. There is a real science to direct mail advertising. How to reach the right people, how to gain readership, how to produce action, how to test the effectiveness of small mailings before going to the expense of large mailings, how to compare relative expense with relative effectiveness of first-class mail versus third-class mail, how to attract special attention to your mailing pieces, how to increase believability of your mail message, how to acquire an effective mailing list and keep it up to date. Several good books have been published on direct mail advertising. At least one can probably be found in your local library and should certainly be studied before spending any amount of money on mailing patriotic literature. Demonstration. Picketing, peace marches, and similar public demonstrations have been effectively used by the more radical left-wing elements. Such demonstrations serve as a primary media to distribute their message. Secondarily, they serve to gain publicity for the group by putting on such demonstrations. For the communists, picketing serves both as a media of propaganda and as a method of mentally conditioning their own people to further action. These tactics can and should be used by patriotic groups. Posters and billboards. Political posters such as our taxed telephone poles are so commonplace as to have little real value in a political campaign. When used in other ways, they can be reasonably effective. Some of the posters, such as Wanted Khrushchev and the anti-union posters, received considerable comment by those who saw them, and the message was repeated in many newspaper accounts of the mysterious posters that were put up during the night. Per dollar spent, few right-wing propaganda campaigns have ever had so wide an audience. Well, we're at the end of the hour, folks. We'll need to put this on hold. And join me again for the next episode of the Hour of the Time, in which we will continue our discussion of the basic training handbook of the American Underground. Good night, God bless you, and God save our republic.
Freedom used to be the old worldwide family network, which Jackie Patrou torpedoed, just absolutely destroyed. Stay tuned, because that was not the end of the broadcast. That was just the end of the first hour, ladies and gentlemen. We have hour number two coming up. Part four of the American Underground series. So, stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
You may be rich or poor, you may be blind, or maybe live in another country.
And no one is.
But you're gonna have to tell somebody. Yes, why? You don't have to tell somebody. It may be in hell, or it may be in God, but you're gonna have to
WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA, 7.415 megahertz. That's 7.415 megahertz worldwide. I'm going to rewind this, folks. I think you need to listen very carefully to this song. I think you need to hear it again from the beginning and all the way to the end. And so here it goes. Pay close attention, ladies and gentlemen. Listen very carefully. Who are you serving, if anyone? And why?
With your tongue, you may be blind.
Serve somebody. And each and every one of you will have to decide who or what it is that you are serving and in what capacity you will choose to serve. We serve the cause of liberty that allows us to worship at the altar of our choice, raise our children according to our beliefs, hold the kind of job that we desire or that we feel we're best suited to, and to just enjoy the peace and quietness of the American life. And these things have all been threatened by circumstances and conditions that we face today. We're continuing with phase 4 of the underground training program where we are dealing with the subject of propaganda. And I would remind you that all of these techniques that we have been reviewing for the past 3 episodes are the same techniques that are being used against us today. And it is very useful to be familiar with those techniques You don't know what the attack is. You won't know how to defend against it. So we're talking now about promoting propaganda, the necessity of it, how it is used properly, and we're on the subject of public meetings. These may be of several types, all the way from small socials in private homes to mass rallies attended by thousands. A large mass rally requires planning, preparation, and careful management. When these things are properly done, they are one of the most effective media known. At such mass meetings, a dynamic speaker can rouse his audience to an emotional pitch that is impossible by any other means. Meetings should never be held simply for the sake of holding meetings. Like all propaganda, they should be designed to produce action. Meetings should have a definite purpose. It should appeal to certain motives and seek to achieve certain objectives. Telephone solicitations. The United States includes more telephones than all the rest of the world put together. The patriotic movement includes thousands of housewives who could easily use this vast propaganda network to good advantage. Once again, each series of phone calls must avoid offending the person called. They should appeal to selected motives, and they should have a predetermined purpose resulting in action. Telephones as a medium lend themselves well to either white, gray, or black propaganda. Careful selection must be made of the proper media to deliver the propaganda message to the desired audience and in the manner most likely to achieve the desired effect. Motive. Very little human activity takes place without reason. Sometimes a person's motive for doing a certain thing may seem simple and obvious. At other times, people act from motives so complex that they aren't even certain themselves as to why they behave in a certain manner. All animal behavior is motivated by two basic instincts, preservation of self and preservation of species. In higher animals, these can be separated into more definite categories. Preservation of self, A, hunger and thirst, B, defense against attack, C, avoiding unfavorable environment such as excess heat, cold, etc. Preservation of species, A, sexual urge, B, mother instinct, C, herd instinct. From these six basic survival instincts develops the motive of competition, both with other species and with other individuals. In the human species, these basic motives become moderated. A man may pass food by on an occasion rather than spoil his appetite, or he may eat to excess because he enjoys the flavor of certain foods. To man, defense against attack has come to mean not only defense against physical attack, but against emotional attack or intellectual attack as well. Witness the duels that have been fought to avenge an attack against one's honor or reputation. Mankind has become very particular about his environment, so that we now seek surroundings that are aesthetically satisfying as well as physically comfortable. Satisfaction of the basic sexual urge has been redefined via emotional involvement in social customs. The mother instinct has been broadened to include a father's love of his own offspring and a natural fondness for all children. The herd instinct still shows itself in crowds, mobs, and cocktail parties. It is also found in the most tender feelings of comradeship. Although human behavior is complex, these six basic instincts are still powerful forces in all of our lives. The propaganda message that skillfully appeals to one of these instincts has a good chance of success. Man's superior intelligence has given rise to other important motivations, such as 1. Desire for new experience, relief from boredom. 2. Desire for recognition, the need for social prestige. 3. Creative urge. 4. Curiosity. 5. The desire to acquire money and personal possessions. All of these are powerful motivating factors, and if properly applied, stand a good chance of obtaining the desired action from the person or persons to whom they are directed. In addition to these basic instincts and motivations, we are all affected by a diversity of emotions: fear, hate, love, jealousy, greed, pity, sorrow. fear probably was once related entirely to the danger of physical harm. But modern man may fear the loss of prestige or of his personal possessions even more. For hate, a situation that could provoke fear is directed toward aggressive action. Various kinds of love include various proportions of the sex urge, the herd instinct, and or the maternal instinct. Jealousy, like the competitive instinct, is a basic development of a long, continuing fight for survival between species as well as individuals. Greed is derived from the hoarding instinct. This instinct to put extra food away for times of future need has had an important influence on the evaluation and survival of the animal species. Foul, of course, results from the loss of a valued possession or cherished companion. Through the process of transference, a situation which would cause sorrow if it happened to us will elicit an emotion of pity when it involves someone else. Through this same mental process, a man may transfer a love for his people into a love for his land. Emotions such as patriotism and loyalty are complex mixtures of more fundamental instincts. They probably differ greatly from one person to another, not only in intensity, but in meaning also. Considerable space has been devoted to motivation, but without it, the propaganda message is worthless. To be effective, propaganda must strongly and skillfully appeal to one or more of the basic motivating factors. The propaganda source. There is often a difference between the actual source of propaganda and its pretended source. In this regard, propaganda is divided into three different types. A, white propaganda. Here, the true source of the propaganda is clearly identified. One example of white propaganda would be the Voice of America that readily admits to originating from radio transmitters operated by an agency of the United States government. Another example of white propaganda are patriotic booklets that clearly state the name and address of the organization distributing them. B, gray propaganda. In this case, the source may be unidentified, or it may pretend to come from some neutral source. Examples would be slanted news stories. Another example would be a radio broadcast from some illegal transmitter that made no mention of its location or who was directing its output. Black propaganda. This type pretends to come from the opposite side. A counterfeit edition of an enemy magazine would be a typical example of black propaganda. Another example was the radio station in Great Britain during World War II that broadcast in the German language and pretended to be operated by the German army in occupied France. Depending on the resources at hand, the message to be carried, the effect desired, and the type of appeal to be made, a decision must then be reached as to the relative merits of black, gray, or white as the most suitable type of propaganda to be used for each individual case. Propaganda intelligence. We have seen how many different things can affect the value of a propaganda campaign. Thus, it is desirable to know all we can about these factors in advance and take all available information into account. Information about the audience is desired. How will they react to a certain situation? What emotional appeal is apt to be most effective with the proposed audience? Which media will reach them most effectively? If shortwave radio is being considered, then it becomes important to know how many shortwave radio receivers are owned by people that the message is meant for. Accurate and complete intelligence is necessary for propaganda to be made effective. Without such good information, the propaganda may do its originators more harm than good. Propaganda security. The propaganda message must be carefully evaluated to make certain it does not give away secrets that should be hidden from the enemy. This is not as easy as it might seem. Propaganda seeks to achieve some purpose. Careful analysis of the propaganda message will usually reveal what that purpose is. Knowing what reaction is desired by the originator of the propaganda may give the analyst a clue to other facts which the propagandist would prefer not to reveal. The problem of security should be considered in preparing each new propaganda message. Production. Each piece of propaganda, as well as each campaign, should be the result of careful research and thought. All the factors considered so far, audience, purpose, motive, media, etc., should be considered in planning both the general campaign and each message that will be a part of that campaign. When this has been done, we then face the task of actual production. The techniques will depend on the media used. In a complete propaganda campaign, several different media may be used, and a different production technique will naturally be required for each. We have mentioned the preemptive position of booklets and similar small printed articles as a media of pro-American propaganda. Therefore, we will go into the design and production of such literature in greater detail. To be of any real value, each piece of literature must do five things. 1, reach the right person. 2, attract favorable attention. 3, hold the reader's interest. 4, tell a convincing story. And 5, get action. Each of these 5 points must be considered carefully. Number 1, reaching the right person. This is probably the biggest single fault of most patriotic propaganda. It reaches the wrong people. Every month, American patriots spend thousands of dollars sending information to other patriots who are already informed of these particular facts. Who is the right person? This depends on the purpose for which that particular mailing is designed. Suppose the purpose is to get the reader to join the fight against communism. There is no use wasting postage sending such a letter to known patriots. They are already active. No use writing the left wingers as they won't be convinced. Such a letter, to be effective, must reach the uncommitted average American. For best effect, a special mailing list, or special means of distribution, should be developed for each separate type of propaganda. Number 2, attract favorable attention. Every day, hundreds of dollars worth of patriotic literature is thrown into wastebaskets without ever being read. Regardless of how well written it may be, the literature will be wasted if it fails to attract favorable attention. Look at some full-page advertisements in any national magazine. Many of them will use two-thirds of the page for a picture and one-third for printing. The picture attracts attention. The printing tells the story. Such companies know how to get the most from every advertising dollar. They rate favorable attention so high that they will gladly spend 66 cents out of every dollar to get it. Pictures are only one way of getting favorable attention. Good, clean paper, a neat job of printing, skillful placement or layout, artwork, variations in type style all help convince the person getting such literature that it is worth his time to read it. The use of colored ink or colored paper should not be overlooked as a means of attracting attention. Even mimeographed literature can attract favorable attention. Here are some general rules. A. Don't crowd the copy. Use plenty of white space. Leave good wide margins. Nothing will discourage the prospective reader more than to receive a page of closely printed material that covers the paper from top to bottom and from side to side. Since it's difficult to include photographs in mimeographed copy, a well-done line drawing may be used. Another trick is to leave the upper one-third of the page entirely blank, except for a single statement or question designed to quickly attract the reader's attention. B. Keep your copy clean. Do a good job of typing a stencil. Plan the position of paragraphs and or illustrations on another sheet of paper before cutting the stencil. Always clean the type of the typewriter so the copy will be clear and easily read. If both sides of the paper are used, then pieces of scrap paper should be slipped quickly between the wet pages as they leave the mimeograph machine. This prevents the wet ink of one sheet from offsetting on the next sheet that lays on top of it. C. Be brief. Plan your message to cover the essential facts in the shortest possible space and still have sufficient emotional appeal. 3. Retain the reader's interest. Expensive paper, elegant printing, and beautiful artwork can still be wasted if the message fails to hold the reader's interest. To do this, we must show the reader how the message affects him personally. It must have emotional appeal. The style of writing must be plain and easily understood. the size and style of pipes that I speak easily with. 4. Tell a convincing story. The message must be believable. It may be true, half true, or completely false, but it must be believable. What is logical to one person may not be logical to another. People tend to believe what they want to believe. Try to appeal to some basic motive or instinct that will make the reader want to believe what you have to tell him. Back up your main points with evidence, testimonials, reasonable arguments, and references. Appeal to the reader with both logic and emotion. 5. Get action. The final purpose of all propaganda is to produce a desired response from the audience. Information has no real value unless it is used. If the propagandist includes information in his message, he must generally tell the audience what to do with it. Otherwise, most of them will do nothing. The action desired is closely related to the purpose of the propaganda. Here are some typical examples. Purpose: to make enemy soldiers homesick. Desired action: cause them to fight less effectively. Purpose: to convince enemy combatants that the civilians at home are getting wealthy while they are risking their lives unnecessarily. Desired action: lower enemy morale. Purpose: to convince the enemy soldiers that most army wives are unfaithful. Desired action: cause them to go AWOL. Purpose: to convince enemy civilians that they cannot possibly win. Desired action: bring pressure on leaders to surrender. Purpose: to picture your side as the underdog but fighting bravely with a good chance of victory. Desired action: gain sympathy and support for your side from neutral forces. Purpose: to describe how the reader will be affected if communism wins control of our country. Desired action: get him to work with an anti-communist organization. Purpose: describe an interesting program or speaker. Desired action: increase attendance at a meeting. Purpose: describe atrocities committed by enemy troops. Desired action: make our own troops fight to the last rather than surrender. The list of possible propaganda objectives and the number of action responses that may be desired is almost endless. To get action, some definite request or command should be included near the end of the propaganda message, such as, join the underground, or mail this application form to the address enclosed, or we'll look forward to seeing you at the meeting next Thursday night. It is frequently possible to include some extra incentive to help stimulate action. A safe conduct pass attached to a surrender leaflet, a business reply envelope enclosed with an application form, or a guest ticket good for one free admission when accompanied by one paid admission, and so forth. General rules of propaganda. A. Propaganda seldom attempts to counteract enemy propaganda. Generally, it's best to simply ignore enemy propaganda and keep pounding away at your own objectives. B. Propaganda must take into consideration the habits, customs, and comparative literacy of the audience to whom it is directed. C. Each propaganda message should be complete in itself. Never assume that the audience has heard your last message and your propaganda can pick up where the last one left off. D. When propaganda is used aggressively against a definite enemy, it should aim at personalities rather than general issues. Remember the newspaper slogan, names make news. E. Propaganda must be carefully dispatched so it is not recognized as such if it is to be of any real value. If recognized for what it is, propaganda is worthless. That is why most Americans will answer no if asked the question, have you ever seen any communist propaganda? F. The propaganda fan should seldom try to create issues, but can more successfully seize on existing issues and turn them to the propagandist's advantage. G. Propaganda must be flexible. The censor fan must be capable of changing abruptly if necessary to comply with changing conditions. A. Propaganda cannot be most effective when operated by remote control. Both design and execution of the propaganda effort must be left with those having closest possible knowledge of the actual audience and the media available to them. I. The propaganda scheme, which is simple and repetitious, will have an advantage over one that is complex or constantly changing. Imaginative slogans can be a valuable part of the propaganda message. J. Propaganda must take advantage of every possible facility for transmitting it to the target audience. Enemy as well as friendly news media must be used by planting news stories and similar stratagems that make them the unwitting carriers of our message. The general population must be induced at every opportunity to help carry the propaganda message. K. Strength and success are the best possible ingredients of military propaganda. Victory in battle is better propaganda than promises of victory. L. Propaganda seldom tries to make direct converts to the doctrine it is designed to propagate. More generally, it seeks to undermine resistance to one's own ideas and weaken the validity of opposing ideas. M. Violence excites the audience and demands attention. It can be a most effective ingredient of the propaganda campaign. N. When the objective is to terrorize, simple threats are not enough. There must be violent deeds which can be exploited in the propaganda message. O. Propaganda is never entirely logical. It pits love against hate, truth against lies, justice against injustice. It must carry an emotional impact. And I'm sure you've noticed how our enemies have used acts of violence as propaganda tools to achieve their political aims. And on that note, let's take a short break. Gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading, specializing in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets, precious metals, gold, silver, and platinum, numismatic coins.
But remember, folks, you will need precious metals. However, the Hour of the Time is not sponsored by anyone. There will be several years since we've had any sponsors whatsoever. So please disregard all commercials, all phone numbers, all addresses, all special offers, and all scheduled events.
1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Swiss America Trading. Reached phase 5, the final phase of the underground training program, recruiting. Recruiting is one of the most important activities of a resistance movement. the overall efficiency of the organization, perhaps its ultimate success or failure, depends on the quality of its personnel. The quality of its personnel depends, in turn, on the efficiency of recruiting methods. A resistance movement cannot remain static. There will be losses, casualties, and perhaps defections. New members must be obtained to fill the vacancies and keep the organization growing. Without constant recruiting, a resistance movement must ultimately wither away. With proper recruiting, it can eventually grow to such a size that ultimate victory is possible. Recruiting can also be a very hazardous activity, especially under totalitarian forms of government or during enemy occupation. The history of past underground armies in other countries demonstrates this fact most vividly. The one thing that most often led to their destruction was the penetration by hostile elements that infiltrated their ranks as new recruits. A good recruiting system must therefore meet the following requirements. A. It must be efficient. This means that the recruiting system must not use up a disproportionate amount of the organization's time and resources. It must produce an adequate return for the effort exerted. B. The recruiting system must be selective. By this we mean that the methods used must not only bring in the necessary number of recruits, but they must find and obtain the needed kind of recruits, including those with leadership ability, technical competence, and perseverance to see the job through to the finish. C. The system must be secure. It must have built-in safeguards for weeding out infiltrators. Also, it must not expose the identity of those already within the organization during their attempts to find and recruit new members. D. The recruiting methods must be dependable. Leaders of an underground army must anticipate their personal requirements on a month-to-month and year-to-year basis. They must be able to rely on the organization's recruiting system to supply these needs. It is doubtful if any one recruiting system meets all of these requirements. At the same time, there are literally dozens of methods and variations that can be used. Roughly, these different methods may be classified into three groups: general recruiting, personal recruiting, and specific recruiting. The term general recruiting refers to the many different activities by the organization or its members that cause others to voluntarily request membership. There was a time when this was done by the very simple and direct act of placing advertisements in the sporting sections of various newspapers. These ads, which read, quote, "Join the Underground Resistance Movement, an organization of patriotic Americans dedicated to the defense of both national and individual freedom," close quote, were a form of general recruiting and were effective at that time. Of course, this method now seems ridiculously unsafe and naive. At the time, however, it proved to be quite effective. It enables us to locate isolated individuals in many areas where we had no previous contacts. In fact, some of our best leaders are now men who once answered such newspaper advertisements. Of course, this method lasted only till the liberal establishment realized what we were up to, and then nearly all major newspapers refused to take the ads. Another tactic is to advertise something for sale, which would most likely be purchased by people of the type most apt to be prospective recruits. This method is still being used effectively by both the national organization and locally by individual bands. The hundreds of thousands of patriotic leaflets, stickers, and other pieces of literature that our members have left scattered about have also proven to be an effective means of general recruiting. These methods of general recruiting are efficient, that is, they do produce a large number of prospective recruits in proportion to the time and effort expended. They are safe so far as protecting the identity of the person placing the advertisement or distributing the literature is concerned. It is not secure so far as the new recruit is concerned. All too often, they will put their return address on the envelope when writing in for information. They are untrained. General recruiting methods are not selective. They bring in a lot of good people, but they also bring in many undesirables. The latter must, of course, be weeded out by other means. Most methods of general recruiting presupposes reasonable freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly. As these freedoms are gradually denied to the organization, ever greater caution and deception must be used. Personal recruiting methods require one or more members of the organization to personally find, evaluate, and recruit each new member. Such methods are less efficient, but are more selective than general recruiting. personal recruiting involves three separate steps. As conducted by professional intelligence agencies, a different person performs each separate task. These three individuals are referred to as the tipper, the researcher, and the recruiter. The tipper is the person who originally sends in the tip to the organization that such and such a person might be qualified and obtainable as an intelligence agent or potential member of the underground movement. The tipper may work at his or her job either part-time or full-time. Actually, that should be the part-time job of every member of the organization. Everyone we meet, no matter how casually, should be quickly evaluated as a potential member. The tipper passes on to his band leader or regional coordinator the name, address, and whenever possible, the telephone number of the potential recruit. He also includes all the information he has about this individual, with any suggestions whereby further information about them may be obtained, and a brief resume as to how they met the potential recruit, or the source of their information about them. The average member in his role as a part-time tipper will keep his eyes open for potential members as he goes about all of his daily activities. The full-time tipper makes it a special point of joining many different organizations, attending social functions and other activities where they will meet a maximum number of people. Many full-time tippers go so far as to change jobs frequently for this purpose. As he gains experience, a tipper learns to look for subtle clues that may alert him to potential underground recruits, intelligence, or espionage agents. Surprisingly enough, patriotism is not necessarily an essential qualification. None of us are born patriots. This is something we learn from sources outside of ourselves. The fact that a potential recruit has not yet had the opportunity or occasion to develop a strong sense of patriotism prior to the time he or she comes to the attention of the tipper should not be considered a great obstacle. The quality of patriotism may be developed or strengthened during the training process. Good basic character, intelligence, and emotional stability are the principal qualifications. There is perhaps one other essential qualification that is more difficult to define. All of us want to feel that our lives are meaningful. This usually means that we are engaged in meaningful work, that our talents and abilities are being used to achieve some worthwhile purpose. If such is not the case, then a person will consciously or subconsciously be dissatisfied. Look for the person whose abilities are not being fully utilized. In other words, look for persons who are looking for a cause. Such a person is the best possible candidate for our work. What greater cause can a person possibly work for than the cause of freedom? What possible tasks could be more meaningful to utilize a person's time and talent in the fight to preserve our liberty for future generations? Under the ideal conditions, the tipper's work should be finished once he submits the prospect's name and basic data. It then becomes the job of the researcher to learn all he possibly can about the prospect, his general background, family, education, work experience, basic religious and political beliefs, general character, habits, personality, friends, hobbies, temperament, and many other factors must be carefully investigated. Remember, we are looking for quality, not quantity. This investigation should, if at all possible, include at least one personal interview between the prospect and the researcher. During this investigation, and especially during the interview, the prospect should not be given the slightest hint that he is being investigated. Neither the tipper nor the researcher should indicate to the prospect in any manner that they are members of this organization or that they have any particular interest in him. If the tipper and researcher both belong to the same unit, and if the prospect is being considered as a possible member of that unit, then the decision to recruit or not to recruit is the responsibility of the unit leader. If the prospect is a person of special importance, or if the researcher is working under the direction of higher organizational leadership, then the decision lies with that leadership. Following a favorable decision, the prospect is then contacted by the recruiter. Of the three members involved, only the recruiter identifies himself as a member of the organization. And even in this case, only when he has satisfied himself that an invitation to join will be met by a favorable response. Time does not permit a complete description of the methods which the recruiter may use in convincing his prospect. Here are some basic guidelines. A. Do not rush. Although a single interview may suffice in some cases, other cases may require several meetings to accomplish the objective. B. arrangements for the interview must provide quiet, privacy, and sufficient time for the recruiter to cover his material thoroughly. C. By his dress, speech, manner of presentation, and in every other possible way, the researcher will attempt to impress the prospect with the seriousness of the situation and the importance of the meeting to the prospect personally. The fact that the recruiter can begin his interview by revealing and confirming a considerable amount of personal data about the prospect will help considerably in this regard. D. During the meeting or meetings, the recruiter must accomplish seven things. First, he must be given a thorough and convincing picture of the communist threat. Second, he must be convinced that the communists can and will win with the tactics they are now using, whereas our government cannot possibly win with the tactics they are now using. Third, he must be convinced that the communists already have such complete control over the American news media and political processes that it is impossible to change our own government's policies by the customary means of politics and public opinion. Fourth, the prospect must be convinced that a life and death conflict is raging right now between the forces of freedom and the advocates of world slavery, the chief weapons of which are espionage, subversion, propaganda, and psycho-political warfare. Fifth, he must be convinced that our government is not using these weapons effectively, that if the American people expect to be saved from slavery, they are going to have to do so themselves. If the prospect thinks that only the government has the resources for such a job, then the recruiter must remind him that the government has nothing except what it first takes from the people. It is in the hearts and souls of over 200 million American citizens that our real strength lies. If the government won't do it, then the people must and can. Six, the prospect recruit must be convinced that we are the most experienced, most dedicated, and best disciplined organization that is involved in this fight at the grassroots level, that we have a program that holds promise of ultimate victory. And seventh, the prospect must be convinced that he is personally needed to perform an important task that urgently needs to be done, and that his energy and ability will be best utilized as a part of the organization. In actual practice, we must, unfortunately, sometimes compromise what we should do with what we can do. In the case of recruiting, this is most often true regarding the work of the researcher. We obviously can't call up a man's employer or go banging on his neighbor's doors or probing into his private affairs. Yet it is essential that we obtain, by tactful and unobtrusive means, a fair picture of the recruit's loyalty, ability, personality, and other important qualifications. All this takes time, as well as tact and experience. Like most members of our organization, all our trained researchers must hold down regular jobs during the normal work week and try to squeeze their organization work into their evenings and weekends. To properly research a single prospect may require several evenings. Thus, our researchers cannot possibly do all the work that is expected of them. In many cases, we won't even have a qualified researcher within reasonable driving distance of the prospect's residence. In such cases, the tipper must act as researcher also. This means that when the average member runs into a likely prospect and sends in this information, he should make his report just as complete as humanly possible. In addition to such obvious information as the name, address, phone number, age, and sex of the prospect, this report should include the prospect's occupation, not only the type of work he is now doing, but jobs he has held or occupations he has been engaged in previously. The report should cover not only the prospect's political philosophy, but as much as can be learned regarding the political beliefs of his close relatives. Information about his close friends is valuable, since it is often true that a man is known by the company he keeps. An accurate physical description of the prospect is desirable, along with comments on his personality, speech, and other mannerisms. The report should include the tipper's thoughts as to how the prospect may be of value to the organization. It is not by any means essential that the prospect be actively interested in the study of classical guerrilla warfare. I'm thinking, for example, of one member who has never shot a gun or paid a month's due, but he does make his private plane available to the organization any time it is needed. Of an attorney that isn't the least bit interested in field maneuvers, but will provide legal advice. Keep in mind that within a resistance movement, four non-combatants are needed for every one guerrilla fighter. to encourage our members to locate prospective members, especially those qualified to hold jobs requiring special ability or training. We have available a printed form, which we call a prospective data form. A number of these forms, which are printed on 8.5 by 11 pages, contain spaces for this and other information. Keep a few of these forms on hand at all times. Keep alert at all times for those persons having the physical, mental, and patriotic qualities that are needed by an organization dedicated to the final defense of our national and individual liberty. This does not mean that the prospect data form need be made out for each new member recruited into your own band. To do so would needlessly swamp the limited clerical staff. They should be used only when a special security check is needed or a person whose potential value would make a special recruiting effort worthwhile. While the tipper and researcher may of necessity be one and the same person, the actual recruiting should, if at all possible, be done by a different member. Unless the new recruit is assigned to the same band as the tipper or researcher, they need never know whether the prospect actually does or does not become a member of the organization. Even when a single person acts as a tipper, researcher, and recruiter, it is desirable that he follow this same sequence of events. The recruiting effort should always proceed in an orderly manner without neglecting any essential steps. The tipper will make a bad mistake if he goes out looking for some particular type of prospect. It is equally bad to overlook a possible recruit simply because he does not fit the tipper's preconceived opinion of what a good member should be. We are asking the recruit to give his time and his money. We are asking him to disrupt his normal life and do without many of the luxuries that most people value so greatly. If we expect the recruit to accept our offer, we must provide him with some very compelling reasons for doing so. Not all people will do the same thing for the same reason. One person may join an underground movement for patriotism, another for revenge. Another may join out of respect for a unit leader. Still another may join simply to find excitement. Almost anyone can be of some value to the organization. Salesmen make excellent recruiters. Businessmen are needed in administration. Housewives who will pledge just 2 hours a day as analysts for the intelligence department are urgently needed. Taxi drivers, hotel bellhops, and telephone switchboard operators are excellent sources of information. Truck drivers are needed as couriers. A waitress in a truck stop can first help recruit the drivers and then act as a live drop for the transfer of messages. Secretaries for various projects are needed very badly. The high school boy of today may be the unit leader of tomorrow, and today's high school girl may be tomorrow's intelligence specialist. The list can go on and on. It is hard to imagine any trade or occupation that would not be of value to an underground organization. Do not discard prospective members too quickly just because they are not fully informed. Pay less attention to what the prospect is right now. Give greater consideration to what the prospects can become after they receive proper training. The one type of person we don't need is the habitual babbler who is psychologically incapable of adopting verbal security measures. There are several points from our propaganda training that can be of value in recruiting. Much of the recruiting process involves a kind of propaganda. Both the recruiter and the propagandist must see that their message reaches the right people. Only a certain percentage of any audience will believe a given propaganda message. Only a certain percentage of prospective members will respond to a recruiting effort. The law of averages will work in both cases. The surest way of getting more recruits is to talk to more prospects. Both the propagandist and the recruiter must hold the interest of their audience and must tell a convincing story. A recruiter must be prepared to back up his statements with logic, testimonials, official documents, or other appropriate proof as may be necessary. The recruiter, like the propagandist, must aim his presentation at strong, basic motives. A person's motives may change with time and experience. The member who originally joined simply to seek relief from boredom may end up fighting for patriotism. The researcher's most effective job is to correctly decide which emotional appeal will be effective with that particular individual. The final objective of both propaganda and recruiting is to produce action. In the case of propaganda, the type of action may vary greatly. In recruiting, the objective is always the same, to obtain the willing cooperation of a prospective new member. This brings us to the third type of recruiting techniques, specific recruiting. This is used to bring into the organization some particular individual who, by virtue either of the position they hold in some organization or some specific information they possess and are extremely important to our organization. Such persons may be of many types. He may already be a patriot, perhaps a member, or even the leader of some other organization with whom we wish to form a close affiliation. The prospect may be completely neutral in their political beliefs. For example, the personal secretary of some important politician or other person whom we wish to influence or about whom we wish information. The prospect might even be a member of the enemy apparatus or a fellow traveler that we might be able to recruit as a spy for our own organization. Specific recruitment usually begins by having confidential members of the underground become personally acquainted with the prospect. After careful study and evaluation, a plan is developed as to how this particular prospect might best be influenced. Based on his individual personality, beliefs, position, background, and similar factors, a regular sales plan is worked out to meet the requirements of each case. Generally speaking, this plan must accomplish the same seven objectives as outlined under personal recruiting. Usually this must be done much more thoroughly and subtly. With personal recruiting, a single interview may frequently suffice, whereas such an occurrence would be rare in the case of specific recruiting. More likely, one or more members would have to continue a personal acquaintance with the prospect for several days, weeks, or months. During this time, the prospect is very carefully given certain information, presented in a manner calculated to be most easily accepted by him, and without our member ever, in any way, appearing to try to influence the thinking of the prospect. On occasion, the prospect may end up thinking that it is he who is trying to convince the member that stronger steps must be taken to combat the threat of communism. One or more of the seven steps referred to may be unnecessary, or may be especially difficult, or especially important, depending on the conservative, neutral, or liberal viewpoint of each particular prospect. The typical conservative will not need to be convinced as to the threat of communism, but it may, on occasion, prove difficult to convince him that political activity will prove inadequate to the task. Frequently, it is the political neutral that proves easiest to recruit by specific recruiting techniques. Here, the principal requirement is to convince the prospect that he or she is personally needed and that they must set aside other personal activities to perform the task assigned them. In recruiting the spy within the ranks of ultra-liberalism, these techniques may be backed up with stronger pressures bordering on blackmail, threats, or bribery. Still, a genuine change in the prospect's political beliefs should be created if at all possible. Actual recruiting systems will not always fall clearly into one of the three basic methods of general recruiting, personal recruiting, and specific recruiting. Regardless of the method used, the overall recruiting effort must be regarded with the utmost seriousness by all members of the underground organization. It must be constantly pursued with cautious energy. It must, in its final effect, meet the four basic requirements of efficiency, selectivity, security, and dependability. We must constantly keep in mind those seven basic facts that must be used in converting a prospective member to our point of view. If all these requirements are met, the end product will be an effective and successful organization made up of enthusiastic and energetic members loyal to the heritage of our forefathers, to the ideals of America, and dedicated to the very end that we shall never surrender. Good night, and God bless each and every one of you, and God save the Republic.
And that's it for tonight, folks. That's all there is for tonight. We'll open the phones now. And if you'd like to call and give us your comments, I had to go and unplug the new phone so that it doesn't ring in your ears. If you would like to call 520-333-4578, comment on what you've heard tonight and last night, now's the time to do it. 520-333-4578. And we'll take calls for a few minutes. And then we're going to be up against the end of the hour. So, what I'm trying to do here is find a shuffle off the Buffalo thing. Oh, there's a good one. Let me just figure out which one that is. Whoops. File 20-333-4578. Okay, let's see which one it is. Here's the number. And we'll take your calls for just two more minutes until the end of the broadcast. That is, if we get any calls. I don't know if we'll get any. We may not. And if we don't, it means either nobody's listening or nobody has any comments. One of the two. And both could have fun, I guess. Maybe nobody's listening, and maybe all the nobody's listening have absolutely no comments. So, if that's the case, then we'll just shuffle on off. If it's not the case, then the phone will ring sometime soon. And you know what? It can't ring because I've got the uplink to WBCQ. I'm going to tell you what you have to do if you want to call. If you want to call, you have to call 520-333-4543. And listen carefully if you want to call. It's 520-333-4543. And I'm not sure that you can do that either. So, you know, let's just forget about that because I think the computer is on that line. And I think we've got all the phone lines tied up. And this is... I haven't done this in a long time, but I switched the phone lines to link up with WBCQ so that I could do some research on the computer tonight. And the computer, I know, is still online. And we're on WBCQ with 4578, so you can't call. And I apologize sincerely for forgetting all of that, but I did. I forgot what I was doing here. And that's okay. Sometimes I forget. Sometimes I make mistakes. And sometimes I make some pretty big ones. Most of them you never know about. I'm so thankful for that. But tonight, you know, I caught myself in a good week. So you can't call. So folks, we'll see you on Monday night with the hour of the time. And don't forget, if they can indict Slobodan Milosevic, who is the elected head of a sovereign state, and issue arrest warrants for his arrest, then world government is not a conspiracy theory. World government is not some kind of a fictional thing. World government is real. It's here, right now. And if they can do that to Slobodan Milosevic, they can do it to you. There is no sovereign, there are no sovereign nation states anymore. No one is safe from the New World Order. Now, if you don't believe that, you sit down and think about it for a while. Slobodan Milosevic is the elected head of a sovereign nation. We've just indicted him for crimes against humanity and issued warrants for his arrest. If they can do that to him, they can do it to anybody in the entire world. There is no such thing as sovereign nation states or sovereign individuals. World government is real, it's here right now, and it is flexing its muscles. Everything we've been telling you over the years is coming true only at a more rapid pace than any of you ever dreamed. And you'd better wake the hell up real quick, because as the world government cements its authority, your liberties and freedoms fly out the window. You're never going to see them again unless a lot of people are willing to die to get them back. So, here, folks, you better pay very close attention. Good night. And God bless you all. Thank you. Sorry about the phone bank, folks. My fault. On your underground service now. Power security network. Form your support network. Do it now. Do it now. Tomorrow will be too late.
Listening to the alternative 50,000 watt voice on WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA.